January 6th uprising, who spent tens of thousands of dollars to organizations promoting book bans. Or we can talk about Betsy DeVos, former education secretary, Amway billionaire, who is financing laws to ban anti-racist teaching, or Charles Koch, or Bear Said, who gave $1.6 billion to right-wing activist Leonard Leo, who used the funds to shape policy through organizations like the Free to Learn Coalition, the misnamed Free to Learn Coalition that was active in Virginia's 2021 election.
You're listening to Jesse Hagopian on the War on Education. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
And yes, it's true that most K-12 educators never studied critical race theory, but there's so much overlap with what social justice teachers do teach that when liberals' only response to like Moms for Liberty and all these groups, liberals would just say, well, we're not teaching critical race theory. And you heard that from so many Democratic Party politicians, right? That was their response to all these laws banning Black history, banning LGBTQ plus identity. We're not teaching critical race theory. But what about the question of should we be? Right? They didn't want to touch that because they're funded by the same billionaires who are uncomfortable with young people learning the origins of this country. And so people like Natalie Wexler, a senior contributor to Forbes and a liberal uncritical race theorist, she wrote this: if Democrats want to win elections and allow kids to get a meaningful education, they should stop dismissing parents' complaints about critical race theory as nonsensical fabrications. It would make sense to avoid teaching concepts like white privilege. So in other words, let's lie to kids about race. And how did that work out for the Democrats? Okay, well, they are morally bankrupt because they didn't stand up to fight for anti-racist education, and they lost the House and the Senate and the White House. The refusal to defend honest education about race has demoralized large swaths of the Democratic Party's base, and the evidence is just everywhere. And, you know, Diane Ravitch wrote something really interesting, too, about what was going on with billionaires and the Democratic Party around these truth crime laws. And she wrote this, quote, "The most puzzling aspect of this coordinated effort to suppress the teaching of accurate history is the silence of people who should have spoken up to defend the schools and their teachers. The most prominent no-shows on the ramparts is Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona under Biden, right? And then she writes, where was Bill Gates? Although right-wing wingnuts attacked Bill Gates for spreading CRT, Gates said nothing to defend the schools and teachers. He is not known for his shyness. Why the silence about teaching the nation's history with adherence to the truth?" Right? A guy who spent his entire life here using billions to rank and sort our children with high-stakes standardized tests and impose standardization, who's in every education debate for the last few decades, all of a sudden is absent and has nothing to say. And I think to understand what's going on with this shift and this massive attack on anti-racist education, on the public schools in general, we have to understand the groundbreaking 1976 book called Schooling in Capitalist America, written by economists Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis, that argued that the structure of education has a direct relationship to the structure of the economy. And they called this the correspondence principle. And the basic idea is that schools are not neutral. They don't just prepare students for life in a general sense. They prepare students to fit into the existing social and economic order. And schools are shaped to reflect and reproduce the needs of the dominant economic system. And so there are many historical examples of how this works, right? We can look at the early 20th century, how industrial capitalism demanded punctual, obedient factory labor. And so schools responded with rigid schedules and rote memorization, authoritarian discipline, vocational tracking, especially for working class students and students of color. Or we can look at the post-war era, you know, the Cold War competition that drove the expansion of STEM education, not to cultivate curiosity or critical thinking, but to produce technocrats, weapon developers, space race engineers to help the U.S. compete with the Soviet Union. And so the idea is that when there are major changes in the economy, the education system also is transformed to reflect those changes to prepare the next generation of workers for that new economy. And so what's going on in our economy right now that is forcing a change in the way our education system is constructed? There's a lot of things, but for time, I want to hit on a couple of them. And one, I think, is just as factories once shaped the structure of schools, I think algorithmic capitalism is now reshaping it through AI and automation. In April, the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, she was at a major ed tech conference. Maybe you saw this in San Diego, and she declared that students across the U.S. would soon benefit from A1 teaching. She said it over and over again, A1 teaching. The moment went viral. Late night hosts roasted her. And A1 steak sauce posted a mock ad that said, "You heard her, every school should have access to A1. It was funny until it wasn't, because behind this gaffe, she was arguing for something very disturbing, right? That we should replace the emotional and intellectual process of teaching and learning with the mechanical process of content delivery, data extraction, and surveillance of artificial intelligence. Bill Gates, in a recent interview, said the AI will get to that ability to be as good as any tutor, as any human ever could. AI will replace doctors and teachers within 10 years. That's their vision for education, one where teachers are replaced by chatbots. And in this system, the goal isn't to liberate students, it's to train them to adapt to machines rather than to question who programs those machines and why. And so we're seeing that change in our schools right now. But I also want to point you to an article by Naomi Klein and Astrid Taylor that was published in The Guardian called End Times Fascism. And they talk about how the climate crisis, the rise of AI, nuclear warfare, and other overlapping crises are leading to what they call end times fascism, right? And billionaires are preparing for end times fascism, not by trying to solve the climate crisis or regulate AI, but by building bunkers, luxury bunkers in New Zealand, and colonizing space. That's why Elon Musk wants to flee to Mars. Right? Good riddance. So in this era of overlapping crises, I would argue that they are trying to reconfigure the education system to instill hopelessness and surrender. All of this means that capitalism is facing a lengthy crisis, and the solution is not to resolve these problems, but to normalize them through education. Schools increasingly operate as sites of emotional management, training young people not to challenge systemic injustice, but to cope with it. And so curriculum focuses on resilience and grit, what they call grit, rather than resistance. And so trauma-informed practices are divorced from any analysis of structural violence, and students are told to recycle, to be kind, to be hopeful, but not to question the fossil fuel industry, or imperialist wars, or political collapse, or economic collapse. Black, indigenous, and Palestinian histories are banned from the classroom. And this is what I call Armageddon academics, a pedagogy that teaches students to accept catastrophe as inevitable and even deserved while suppressing the collective memory of rebellion. And if schools once trained working class children to endure the factory, now they are training students to prepare for the end of the world, to just instill the hopelessness that nothing can be done. And that's why I think that socialists should prioritize the fight for education. It doesn't have to be this way. We've seen proof, and especially in the 2020 uprising, when young people took the lead. At the same time, we were talking about this education gap, that they were hopeless, kids were hopelessly falling behind because they weren't in the classroom. Young people were in the streets teaching the world about systemic racism. And we need to, as a left, as socialists, understand that education is not a side issue. They cannot achieve their fascist goals without capturing the schools and transforming them into sites of hopelessness. And they know that, and that's why they've spent so many billions of dollars to try to transform the curriculum. Mm-hmm. But our side hasn't woken up to that yet. The left and socialists have not made education one of the centerpieces of our fight, right? And when we do, when we make education the focus of the fight for socialism, what you can do is bring in all the other fights. Because you can't fight for education without fighting for immigrant rights, because our children are being snatched out of school by fascist ICE agents. You can't fight for education, right, without fighting for queer students and trans students, because they are criminalizing their existence in schools and kicking them off of their sports teams and not letting them use the bathroom. And so education brings together all these different issues that can galvanize the left. And I think that we need to understand the strategic importance of fighting around education. Education is the most unionized workforce of any workforce in the country. If we are going to survive this climate collapse and the rise of fascism, if humanity has a future left on this planet, it's going to be because the labor movement figured out how to fight. Without a mass fighting labor movement that can shut down the capitalist system and show working people that actually we have the power, actually it's our labor that makes this system run, then we're done with this experiment of humanity. And so if we're going to pick a place to fight, let's start where the place with the most unionized workers that have shown they're willing to fight over and over again. I just want to end with the Teach Truth movement that is growing up around this country and refusing to back down to the uncritical race theorists, because in the beginning of June, we held our fifth annual Teach Truth Week of Action, spearheaded by the Zen Education Project, which is organized by Teaching for Change and by Rethinking Schools. And from Alaska to Puerto Rico, from Hawaii all the way to Barcelona, Spain, over 200 events happened in communities all over. And these events were not just your ordinary rallies. Sometimes they were rallies, but oftentimes they were historical walking tours where educators showed people where the Black freedom struggle had occurred in their own community and showed them what would happen if these truth crime laws were passed in their own jurisdiction, that the history of their community could no longer be taught, right? There were reading flash mobs that that were organized. There were banned book swaps and historical mini lessons on the fight for Black education. And they were held in parks and museums and classrooms and in libraries. And this is the real grassroots movement, right? Of parents and caregivers and students and educators coming together to refuse the imposition of these truth crime laws. And I want to suggest that we combat these truth crime laws. We combat what Professor Henry Giroux called the violence of organized forgetting with what I write about in the book, The Healing of Organized Remembering. And the radical healing of organized remembering identifies collective efforts in education, but also in social movements, to uncover purposefully concealed historical lessons that are vital for recovering from historical trauma and for building healthy social movements for justice. And I don't have time to explain everything I mean about the healing of organized remembering, but I want to give you one example of what it can look like. Because I started teaching at my alma mater at Garfield High School in Seattle a little over a decade ago. And my first class I was assigned to was to teach AP US History. And, you know, they wanted me to teach to the test, and that's not really my gig. And so I went to the Zen Education Project, and I was actually hired a couple months into the school year, so I had no time to prepare. I didn't even know what class I was teaching the first day I got into the room. So I had to scramble to find lessons. So I went to the Zen Education Project and just started going through everything they had to teach U.S. history. And, you know, so I taught lessons like the one on abolition, where the students all become different members of different abolitionist organizations, and they have to debate the strategies for how to overthrow slavery. And then they compare what they came up with to what the actual abolitionist organizations did. We did the same for the women's suffrage movement. We did the same for the civil rights movement. They all become members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they have to debate, should we allow white college students to join SNCC? Will they be effective in reaching rural Mississippi sharecroppers who we want to organize into the fight, right? Should we prioritize the fight to register people to vote, or should we prioritize a fight for direct action and sit-ins? So they take the actual debates, and then they debate it through and then compare what the real SNCC decided to do, right? We did that for the Vietnam War and so many other issues. And at the end of the school year, you know, a lot of them ended up doing very well on the AP exam, even though we hadn't properly prepared for it, because they loved history and they wanted to actually study it. But I told them that that's not actually when they passed my test. It was the following year when the state legislature announced that they were going to cut billions of dollars from the education budget in Washington state. This was in the wake of the Great Recession, when hundreds of teachers were laid off across Washington state and thousands across the country. And our state constitution in Washington declares that education is the, quote, paramount duty of the state. And it was clarified by the courts that that meant it, that the state had to spend over half of the budget on education. And they'd been in violation of that law for many years. So many of us in our radical social justice union caucus, we believed it wasn't just immoral that they were cutting billions from education. We believed it was illegal. And so we went down to the session where they were getting ready to cut those billions of dollars, and we were able to get into the House Ways and Means Committee meeting where they gaveled in the session to cut the billions, and we mic checked the room and we read out the state constitution. We declared that we were at the scene of a crime, not just any crime, the highest crime. You're violating the highest law of our state. Well, you might not be surprised to hear that the police officer in the room did not have the same interpretation of the law that I did. And he ended up arresting me instead of the state legislature, especially when I pulled out a pair of plastic handcuffs and invited them into my custody for a citizen's arrest. They did not appreciate that. So I spent the night, I spent the evening in jail. And when I got out, I went to Garfield High School the next day, and a kid came running up to me before I got into the building. And he said, "Mr. Hagopian, it worked." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, I started a Facebook page called Free Mr. Hagopian, and here you are. Thanks for getting me out, man." This was one of my students that went through that class the year before, right? Who had learned the history of social movements. And then you know what he did next that was magical? He turned that Facebook page into a page that said, "Walk out against the budget cuts." And the very next day, in 24 hours, they organized a mass walkout of over 500 students that marched down to City Hall. They had flyers, they had banners. It was just incredible. Demanded an audience with the mayor. They got their picture in the New York Times. They wrote an op-ed for the Seattle Times. They organized a citywide walkout. They started an organization. They put pressure on the state legislature and on the state Supreme Court. And within just a couple of months, the state Supreme Court ruled in our favor that it was in fact in violation of the law, and they were forced to add billions more dollars to the education budget. Just a resounding victory. That is what uncritical race theorists really fear. They know we're not shaming white children in these classes. They know we're teaching white children about John Brown, about Anne Braden, about the Grimke sisters, about Howard Zinn. We're teaching them about multiracial social justice movements. And that's what they fear. They fear that our kids are going to learn those lessons and then go out and apply them in the real world. And that's what I mean by the healing of organized remembering. And so I'll just end with an idea about what we're fighting for, because we have immense challenges in our world today. But we have a key advantage that has led to incredible victories for justice throughout history, and that is that they are very few and we are many. The richest 1% use their wealth to manipulate the education system, but the good news is they are only 1%. But they're only 1% if we overcome the divisions of racism and homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia. Otherwise, we're all 1% in our own little enclaves. And so that's why education is central to the fight for socialism. We have to teach people the history of multiracial struggles. We have to teach people how they invented race consciously to divide and conquer working people if we hope to win. And because the classroom isn't just a place of instruction, it's a place of possibility where the next generation can begin to learn not just how the world is, but how to transform it. There have been many names given to the destination of those seeking relief from racism and oppression, and I want to just end with reading a passage from the conclusion of my book about what the goal of our destination is. The poet Phyllis Wheatley, who had been enslaved and kidnapped from West Africa before gaining her freedom and becoming the first African-American author to publish a book of poetry, called the destination deliverance. She wrote, quote, "In every human breast, God has implanted a principle which I call love of freedom. It is impatient of oppression, and it pants for deliverance." The great gospel soul band, the Staple Singer, called our destination simply a place in their hit single, "I'll Take You There." And they told us that in this place, no one would be smiling at us while they lied to our face. You know that song, "I'll Take You There"? Yeah. Martin Luther King called our destination the beloved community. He wrote, quote, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of a beloved community." The Black Panther Party called it socialism. As member Asada Shakur put it, capitalism meant that the rich businessmen owned all the wealth, while socialism meant that the people who made the wealth owned it. Stevie Wonder called our destination higher ground, and he invited us in his sonically soaring refrain to keep on going until we reach it. And this higher ground is not an isthmus with only room for a few. There is room for everyone, and you're all invited to join us there. Thank you.
You were just listening to Jesse Hagopian on the War on Education. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Jesse Hagopian is a Seattle-based educator who has taught in public schools for over 20 years. He's the author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuke, Claudia De La Cruz, Arundhati Roy, Gabor Mate, Chris Hedges, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Jesse Hagopian on the War on Education, and for Jesse Hagopian's book, Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
This is Bird Note. Isaiah Scott was in middle school when his family took him to visit the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He remembers being blown away by a painting called The Wall of Birds.
It's this beautiful, huge mural with like the map of the world, but it had these colorful birds. And I was like, wow, I didn't know there was this many birds with different colors and different sizes and bill morphologies. And it just made me recognize the beautiful diversity of birds all around the world.
He marveled at the blue-footed booby in the Galapagos Islands, the osprey diving above the Florida Peninsula, and hundreds more life-sized birds painted by artist Jane Kim.
From that point, I was like, I want to know more about birds. Like, I want to go out and see what birds that I find and how many of these birds on this wall that I could potentially see one day.
Isaiah bought his first pair of binoculars from the gift shop and started birding. Years later, he returned to Cornell to study ornithology and science communication as an undergrad. And now, Isaiah shares his love of birds on social media, guided hikes, and through his own artwork, thanks to that first spark.
Ever since then, I just been pointing my eyes towards the skies with my binoculars.
You can learn more about Isaiah Scott and the Wall of Birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Joni Franklin.